All right, so first couple weeks of the quarter, we've talked a lot from the first couple of chapters about the structuring of the camp. God has brought structure to his camp, putting tribes in their specific places. And then even the censuses, the ordering of the tribes and the way that they're counted. And so one of the things that you see going on here in the book of Numbers is, in a very real sense, this is important for where we're going to be tonight, chapters 5 and 6 in a few minutes. Literally in organizing the camp, in taking account, and even the orderliness of the way the counting is being done, you're seeing a continuation of what was going on in the book of Leviticus. You know, book of Leviticus fundamentally is a book about holiness, right? It's a book about boundaries, about clean and unclean, and about sin and death, and about how to expiate sin and make clean again when things have become unclean, whether symbolically, you know, because you touched a dead corpse, or, you know, because a woman's menstruating or gave birth, whatever, you know, the stuff of life, but it can still make you unclean. To the moral issue, sin. And in the book of Leviticus, of course, what we sometimes call the ceremonial aspects of uncleanness were meant to just constantly remind Israel symbolically of the larger spiritual dimension of life, that you know, the goal is to stay clean, because you can only come into God's presence when you are holy, right? And so that's the basic, you know, be holy for I am holy. In fact, a lot of commentators even call the whole last, about third of the book of Leviticus, from chapter 17 to 27, the holiness code. Go back and look at the predominance of that word holy. And that's actually Leviticus. And so there's a sense in which if the book of Leviticus was about holiness. And remember, holiness first and foremost, the concept of holiness, this is important because this brings us back into the book of Numbers. The concept of holiness first and foremost is not moral. The basic concept of holy is simply respecting boundaries and lines that God has drawn. Everything's in its proper category, everything's in its proper place, right? Because objects can be holy or unholy. It doesn't mean an object can sin, but there were objects that were holy to the Lord. That is, they were set apart, you know, to be used as, say, vessels in the worship of the tabernacle or something like that. Holy objects. They can't sin or not sin. The idea is they're set apart. Fundamental concept of holiness, and if you're with me in Exodus last quarter, we talked about, even all the way back to Exodus, this is where God begins to come down and dwell among human beings again. How can a holy God? Remember what God said to Moses when Moses sees him at the burning bush? Take your sandals off, because where the presence of the Lord is, there is holiness. And holiness by definition is he's other. You know, he's separate. He is the uncreated creator. And so holiness just radiates from God, and for impure and sinful people, it's destructive, it's catastrophic, it's a consuming fire. So from Exodus, where God begins to dwell among the human race again, not just appearing to patriarchs individually here and there, he comes out on Sinai publicly, visibly, after smashing Egypt. He makes a covenant with people, the whole point being, so I can dwell among you. It's the beginning of recreation. The fundamental, you know, drama of the Bible is God creates, fall happens, and sin brings with it uncreation. The ultimate uncreation is death. And the prophets talk about this elsewhere. It's in the class on the prophets, but the prophets very much use the imagery of sin and the fall as an aspect of uncreation. The good orderliness of God begins to unravel, culminating in death. Because what God did in the beginning of creation was holy. He created boundaries, right? He creates light and dark, separates them. He creates sky and water, and those what? Separates, you know, right? Dry land from water, separation. The whole concept of creation is God, and what makes it good is God ordering things, putting things into their right places. Everything is holy, set the way God wants it to be. Sin blurs all those lines, uncreates, blurs the good lines that God has drawn. And so in Exodus, God comes down and begins to reset holiness. He's going to dwell with the human race. As you go into Leviticus, he gives a law that defines holy and unholy, clean and unclean, very clearly. Gives you object lessons in daily life to remind you of the moral realm of being set apart. Don't be like the nations. Don't be like the sin out there. Live in a different way. And the invasiveness of Leviticus. You know, all these laws, even the ceremonial ones, are meant to be invasive. The whole idea is every aspect of your life, everything that you do, you should think about how does this impact my relationship to God, my holiness, every aspect of it. What you eat, where you walk, where you go to the bathroom, you know, all of it was regulated. Why? The idea is every aspect of life is meant to be brought back into, I need to think constantly about my God and how to be rightly ordered in my life before. That was the point of Leviticus. And so with the whole giving of a sacrificial system and a law that very clearly regulates clean and unclean, holy and unholy, God continues this reordering of human life at Sinai, having come down. By now arranging the people themselves into an orderly thing. They're no longer that mixed multitude mass that comes out in Exodus chapter 12. He brings order to the chaos of the people. He will set them apart by tribes. He will order the camp. He will give them a marching order, and so on and so forth. He will number them. The whole point of numbering is to set them in order, to give an account of them. Does that make sense? And so literally, so when God comes out on Sinai, he begins to recreate, to bring lines and order back to the chaos of human life. And that's what we're seeing all the way through the rest of the Pentateuch up into Deuteronomy. Does that make sense with me? Holiness, therefore, is the fundamental concept. That matters because of what we're going to see in chapters 5 and 6 in a minute. So he's bringing order step by step by step back to his people. And even as an object lesson in the book of Exodus of how, you know, God is trying to bring order to their chaos, Moses is up on the mountain getting the law, and he comes down with tablets. God says, get down, you know, because the people are going nuts down there with that golden calf. And so remember how this scene is described in Exodus 32 when Moses comes down? Are people acting in order? No, they ate, drank, they rose up to play in the classic description. It was chaos, and that's the whole idea. You know, they were back in the chaos, and therefore God has to, you know, deal with that. So this is the fundamental concept, bringing order to disorder. That's what God does as he recreates. And the tabernacle and all the rituals and religion that surrounds it are the place where God begins to reassert creation patterns. We don't have time to do this. It's not a class on the tabernacle or the temple as such. But even the items of the furniture in various ways kind of partake of imagery from the garden in different ways. The temple itself will, with the trees carved on the doors and the walls. The temple itself will when it's permanently done. But even the items of the furniture in various ways, you know, the lampstand being, you know, carved with like a tree, you know, having aspects of tree-likeness and branches coming off it, and just things like that. God is trying to reestablish a garden, a place where God and man can dwell. He's bringing little bits of creation, original creation, God's original intention in creation, back bit by bit. Okay? And so in one sense, it's then through the Pentateuch, this progress of God bringing holiness, order, divisions, lines, boundaries, categories back to a chaotic and fallen world. Holiness is basically the basis for how we determine what good and evil actually are. And then what he does in the book of Numbers, just kind of to finish our kind of recap and review, so many different ways to conceptualize what goes on. It's a very robust book. You can look at it from multiple angles. But when we get to the book of Numbers itself, then, again, it's a very orderly work. You start in chapters 1 and 2, where even as God brings order to the camp, he considers the outermost part of the camp first. In other words, the 12 tribes. And then in chapters 3 and 4, he considers the Levites and the priests and their numbering and their place in the camp. In other words, remember when we looked first week, we looked at the order of the camp. He's working from the outside, less holy edges, into more holy, the priests and the Levites who are set apart and consecrated, right, in place of the firstborn, right? Outside, a little bit closer in. And then we get to chapters 5 and 6, where we want to pick up tonight. You get the spiritual dynamic of holiness before we get to chapter 7, where we're back to the tabernacle itself, the structure literally in the center of the camp. Before we get to the center of the camp itself and the dedication of the tabernacle, a part of the story that Moses, by inspiration, did not include in Exodus. And we'll talk about the difference between what's said in chapter 7 there about the dedication of the tabernacle as opposed to what happened in Exodus 40. But before we get there, 5 and 6, almost like an interlude as we're working our way to the camp, a substantial meditation as we've worked from the outer tribes to the Levites and the priests before we get to the center, before we get to the tent and the tabernacle itself. This section, chapters 5 and 6, on holiness, the spiritual dynamic, the spiritual operating system of the camp that makes you either fit or unfit to come any further towards the tabernacle. That makes sense? Right? Because remember, one of the priests and Levites' job, we talked about this, I think it was first week, what's their role? It says there in those chapters we're reading.
To guard.
What's the category? What's the standard by which they are to guard? The holiness that the law reveals. And so obviously 5 and 6, there's the whole book of Leviticus, but 5 and 6 are just meant to be a little bit of a recap, flashback, reminder of the standard by which the priests are to be guarding, and the Levites with them are to be guarding. You're like in the sandals of an Israelite walking towards the tabernacle. How do you know whether you're going to live or die as you do so? 5 and 6 are a reminder. 5 and 6 are a reminder about the holiness that's at stake as you work from the outside of the camp towards the presence of God in chapter 7. You with me? Make sense? Okay, so let's go back. 5 and 6. 5 and 6 work together. The chapters work together. Chapter breaks are always, that's not always, always is a big and dangerous word. But they just make breaks where they're not meant to be. 5 and 6 work together. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 4 is kind of a prologue to the section, introduction. Look there in those verses. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, command the people of Israel that they put out of the camp everyone who is leprous or has a discharge, and everyone who is unclean in contact with the dead. You shall put out both male and female, putting them outside the camp, that they may not defile the camp in the midst of which I dwell. That's the issue. Before we get back to the tabernacle itself in chapter 7, what is the fundamental issue why the camp has to be holy? God's going to live among us now. God is going to dwell among us, which means we cannot be what we have been. We cannot be what we have been. And so the people of Israel did so. They put them outside the camp as the Lord said to Moses, so the people of Israel did. Now stop right there for a second. Look at those things. And again, you read the book of Leviticus, you recognize some of the things that are being mentioned here. That was all in Leviticus. And so it's just going to be a little prologue reminder. The priests and Levites are to enforce these standards. But they're not entirely moral standards, right? Can a person help if they're having a bodily discharge? Nope. Can't always help that. It's not moral as such. It's just a reminder that from the non-moral to the ultimately moral, because in verse 11, we're going to start getting some very moral issues very quickly. It's a reminder that even in the way God's going to talk in these chapters, we're working from the outside in. From the non-moral, which is just meant to be an object lesson. Remember what holiness is and live in light of the lines God has drawn. To the moral where you do have, I don't have to have a choice whether I have a bodily discharge or whether I've come into contact with a dead body. But I do have a choice, starting in verse 6. I do have a choice. And so we're again, even there within the structure, we're working from the outside in of holiness. The object lessons of ceremonial holiness, just to constantly remind me. Be conscious of how you're living. To where I do have a choice. Okay? And so we're working from the outside in. And so then, starting in verse 5, we have a couple of different scenarios in chapter 5 before that chapter is over. A couple of different scenarios in which people's holiness is at stake for moral reasons. And so look with me in verse 5? Yeah. So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel. When a man or woman commits any of the sins that the people commit by breaking faith with the Lord, and that person realizes his guilt. So this is not high-handed rebellion. This is somebody who, moment of weakness, season of weakness, but comes to their sentence, like the prodigal son with the pigs, right? And when he came to himself, and they realize their guilt, he shall confess his sin that he has committed, and he shall make full restitution for his wrong, adding a fifth to it, and giving it to him to whom he did the wrong. Remember Zacchaeus? Yeah, Zacchaeus understood this. But if the man has no next of kin to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution for wrong shall go to the Lord for the priest, in addition to the ram of atonement with which atonement is made. This is a reference to especially like Leviticus 5. The vocabulary in English often breaks down for the different classes of sacrifices. Classic English translation, the guilt offering. But the better the sense is the restitution offerings. Some forms of sin require you to try to set things to right to the best of your ability. Guilt offerings not the best translation for that, Leviticus 5 sacrifice. Restitution offerings better. Sometimes you can set things right. Some things you can't undo. You commit adultery. How do you repay somebody back from that? That's a little harder to do. You steal, or something like that. That's something that you can set back to rights, right? So some sins can be restituted. But if the man, has no next of kin to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, here the issue is, so, again, God knowing human nature. Okay, Lauren's laughing because she's wicked like I am. We both think the same way. Statute of limitations, right? I know. I'll make it right after he's dead. The law accounts for that. No, okay, so, you finally decide, you've lived in sin, you set it right. but the guy had a son. What do I need to do now? Make it right with the son. I can't pay dad back because dad's passed away. I can say go right the son. So, but occasionally they're still running a scenario. So even there, God says, uh-uh, not so fast. You pay it to me then. Give it to the priest, you know, as a way of setting it apart to me. The bottom line is if you can set it to right, you will set it to right. Set it to right with the person you sinned against if you can, but if you can't, set it to right with me. But no getting out, no statute of limitations, no you know, playing the waiting game. And you laugh, but people do that. Elders can tell you, we deal sometimes with marriage and divorce situations where somebody's waiting on that spouse to cheat, you know, after you divorce them, pass away or cheat or whatever. Listen, God doesn't like playing lawyerly games with his law. And so here's an example of that back in the old law. Don't play games with me, is what God is basically saying. Don't play games with me on this stuff. All right, so you got to set it to right. Verse 9, and every contribution, all the holy donations, oh, there's that word, all the holy donations of the people of Israel, which they bring to the priest, shall be his. Each one shall keep his holy donations. Whatever anyone gives to the priest shall be his. Now here's the thing. Again, just like the prologue sets up kind of snapshots, this is a snapshot of a, let's call it a social and fairly public sin. You think a guy knows or his neighbors know or his family knows when you say stolen about him or you bore false witness about him or whatever, right? Yeah, yeah. People are going to know that that's a social slash public issue, right? And so that's kind of what this is a snapshot of. You've got to set that, things are going to be holy, things have got to be set to rights. And that key word holy in terms of when you pay restitution, it's holy. It's given to him, or more importantly, it's given to God. And so you've got to set things to rights in that way. But then what happens in verse 11 is what about more private slash secret slash hidden sins? Obviously, the holiness of God's camp can be impacted by social sin, by sins that are social and public in nature, you know, where you know, your neighbor, your community is obviously impacted, right? But what about more secretive sins, like a wife cheating on her husband, potentially? That happens usually in the dark, you know, so to speak, literally or metaphorically, right? But the point is, it's more hidden. It's less obvious. What about those kind of sins? And God says, I've got a ritual for that because I don't want sin in my camp. And so people who think they can get away with the more hidden secretive stuff, there's a way for, in a sense, invoking the divine aid and ferreting that out as well. God will have a holy camp and a holy people. Now here's the thing. On the surface level, you know, looking at the beginning of this in verse 12 there, speak to the people of Israel, if any man's wife goes astray and breaks faith with him, if a man lies with her sexually and is hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected though she has defiled herself, and there is no witness against her since she is not taken in the act, if the spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife who has defiled herself, or if the spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife though she has not defiled herself, because that's the question. He doesn't know. That's the nature. That's how affairs work, right? And especially if you're having an affair under a law where what's the consequence for being caught in the act? Yeah. So you're not gonna, you know, people have never. Well, okay, I'm not gonna say people have never unless you're at a Coldplay concert. the people. You know, by the way, we live in Isaiah's world. You know, they have no shame in what they do anymore. Except that they did. Oh, they did. And isn't it funny? Y'all see that video? You know, the singer for Coldplay, Amelia. Oh, they're either shy or
having an affair.
Even people of the world know. Even people of the world know what that's all about. So, anyways, but by the way, right there, you want to keep it? What did that CEO want to do in his HR head? They wanted to keep it
secret.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. So. What do you do? But this is God's people. This isn't just pagans running around. This is God's people. He wants a holy camp. Is sin sin, whether the husband knows for sure or anybody else knows what's going on? Is sin sin? Yes. Is the fabric of reality violated? Is the holiness of God's camp and therefore God's dwelling among his people at risk, even if nobody else but the guilty pair knows? Is it still at risk in a sense? The answer is yes. Which, by the way, those of you who are younger or those of us who, you know, you're either raising young people or deal with young people, young people often like to argue, it's just between me and God, or it's just between me and God. It's not. It's not. Because what God's basically saying is this private affair is about to become public. Because that's the other thing, too, especially. Sexual sin always has social and public implications. It just does. It just does. That's another sermon, another class, another quarter, but it does. That whole idea about what happens in consenting adults' private bedrooms is just, no. Society breaks down when the bedroom gets dirty. That's another sermon, another class for another day, but just take it as a fact. So, here we are. Now, by the way, people struggle. What does that mean? The spirit of jealousy comes on the husband. You know, because we hear that language, that kind of makes us think, you know, not so good to the husband, right? It's important to hear that in the context. Now, number one, commentators have wrestled with exactly what it means for the spirit of jealousy to come upon them. Now, one possible understanding of this is this. Is the Spirit of God active among His people in this day and time? The correct answer is yes. And so could God in some way give the husband an inkling that something's not right? Yes. Now, the other ways to look at it is this. We think about sexual activity more in the pleasurable sense. But for most of human history before the pill, it was pleasurable and procreative, right? You know, the pill allowed modern society to separate the pleasure and the procreation. But for most of human history, one, you know, it's two sides of the same basic coin. You with me? Make sense? Okay. So especially, like, here's the thing. Not only is this just God's holiness morally, these are His people, He's going to dwell among them, but there's one other thing that's crucial in that context. These people, everything revolves among these people around this seed promise. The seed promise, right? Through Abraham, all nations are going to be blessed because a seed is coming. A seed of woman is still coming. And so therefore, is it being clear about who's mom and who's dad? Is that a big deal in the society in which the coming of the Messiah is at stake? You better believe it. And we'll go one step further. We see this principle also in this simple sense of God expects from generation to generation things to be handed on decently and in order. That's why Naboth won't sell Ahab his vineyard. Because how did Naboth get his vineyard? From his dad. Where did his dad get it? From his dad. And where did, however far we need to go back, great, 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 you know, times 10, grandfather, where did grandfather of Joshua's day get the land? From God when they cast lots when they went in the land. So in other words, I got this piece of land because God gave it to me. And how big a deal is it? This principle is such a big deal before this very book of Numbers is over. Remember the daughters of Zelophehad? Some of you have been around for a while or read the book before. And what's their question going to be? What happens to our inheritance if there are no brothers, sons, / male heirs? You know, and what do we do about that? Because it matters in this time that the lines of genealogy are kept clean. Make sense? And so there's more. There's just the whole violation of marital vow, which is the basic fabric of reality, back to Genesis 1 and 2, make a man in his image, male and female, be fruitful and multiply and all of that. But also in the context of the Abrahamic covenant and the principles of inheritance as God's people dwell in the land. It matters that you know who your daddy is. Okay, so there's societal chaos breaks down when people don't know who their dad is. You lose your rootedness, your place. Honor thy father and mother. Kind of hard to do when you don't know who dad is, right? Because... And that was the, remember what Paul reminds. That's the first commandment with promise. So again, we see it just as sex. It's just not until relatively recent history. It's just not. Okay? By the way, that's why, not justifying, just making an observation. In hardcore Islamic societies, you familiar with the principle of the honor killing? What's the honor killing all about? Disgrace. Not justifying it, I'm just saying, you know, other people still understand in one sense the seriousness of this principle.
Disgrace upon the family.
Yeah. If a daughter, you know, who is not married, sleeps around, her brothers will
kill her.
Brings the family in disgrace, and you just don't mess. So, setting everything aside, most people for most of human history realize you don't mess with sex. Okay? So, now, I will say this as well. You'll notice there, in the little bit we just read, that maybe she's guilty, maybe she's not. The husband doesn't know that's part of the problem. The spirit of jealousy comes upon him. A couple more things to observe about this. Number one, in Jewish interpretations, what's interesting is they, you know, because we hear that word jealousy, we hear negative. Well, the husband's just, you know, kind of paranoid. Not necessarily. We'll do something with that word jealousy in just a second. It hits differently in Hebrew and in the context of the Pentateuch than we often appreciate. We hear that word negatively in English in our cultural context. But even before that, one of the common lines of Jewish interpretation of what it means for the husband in a spirit of jealousy to want this ritual performed is this, that it's as much for his wife's reputation as anything else. Listen, how many of you, because this was the Jewish scenario that was common in Jewish lines of interpretation of this passage. woman, wife, married woman, winds up in some sort of awkward situation with man who is not her husband, alone. And, you know, for a long period of time, that there's at least questions about what happened. What happened, right? And so this is as much about the wife's integrity as doing something publicly where God basically says, yep, she's guilty, or yep, she's not guilty. This can actually be construed as much about restoring her reputation because she got into an awkward situation as a purely jealous husband. You with me? That makes sense? There's one other aspect of along that line as well, well, just to emphasize. How many of us have sometimes, without intending to, gotten caught in an awkward situation a person of the opposite sex? You know, at work maybe, because you know, we're all careful at work these days, man, especially with HR breathing down our necks. But, you know, you ever had, you know, didn't realize everybody else left the office, it's just you and her now? You ever been, you know, that happens, right? It's not even just always completely sinister. Just sometimes that stuff happens in life. So this can also be as much about the woman having her reputation upheld by God himself when there are questions about the situation, okay? That word jealousy, a little bit more about that real quick. Here's the thing about jealousy. That word hits hard, but it's a sign of the desire for purity in the relationship. We construe it negatively, but what's interesting is in Hebrew, that word, kana, can mean both jealous and zealous, depending on the context. It's the same basic mental state, mental attitude, right? You're extremely interested and devoted to something. And so to put it in perspective, you keep your finger here, but go back with me and look at a couple of passages real quick. Look with me in Exodus chapter 20, when God first comes down on Sinai and he's identifying himself and his character and his nation to his people. In Exodus chapter 20, when God's first coming down on Sinai, and look at what he says there, verse 4. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that's in heaven, above, earth beneath, or the water under the earth. You shall not bow down nor serve them, for I, the Lord, am a... Same word. Same word as Numbers chapter 5. Does that mean God's just paranoid? What does it mean? He's very zealous to keep the relationship pure and above board. Okay? Doesn't mean he's a paranoid, can't trust anybody. God can't, you know, just all those people. You burned me once in the garden, never going to happen again. Got to guard my heart. No, that's not what he's saying. Chapter 34, again, when God is further clarifying. On the other side of the golden calf debacle. And now here's God again clarifying his name and what it means, his character, Exodus chapter 34. And so dropping down to verse 14. For you shall worship no other God, for Yahweh, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. Oh, now it makes sense that God would be a paranoid husband after what happened to the golden calf, right? That's what this is about, right? No. What's the whole point? God will have a clear, holy, no question, pure people. Okay? And so it's not just a paranoia, trust issues. It's zealousness for the purity of the thing. Jealousy for the integrity of the relationship and the absolute clarity that the relationship is above board. For the wife's sake as much as for the husband's sake. And I won't take time to do this. Yeah, we'll just leave it alone. You can chase that idea further into the prophets as well when God starts talking about his people before the exile and after the exile, but I'm not going to take time to do that. So positively, in the ancient Near Eastern sense, this is as much about zeal for protecting and safeguarding the integrity of the relationship as anything else. Okay? So we don't want to hear that it's just, you know, kind of a bitter, paranoid husband who can't trust his wife. You with me? There are even scenarios in which it was as much for her reputation's sake as anything else. Now, the ritual itself is a little bit of an odd one. Besides the sacrificial aspects of it, verse 17, the priest shall take holy water. Oh, there's that word again. That's all over this section. Holy water. In an earthenware vessel, and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it in the water. The priest shall set it before the woman, before the Lord, and unbind the hair of the woman's head, place in her hands the grain offering of remembrance, which is the grain offering of jealousy. In his hand, the high priest shall have the water of bitterness that brings the curse. And the priest shall make her take an oath, saying, if no man has lain with you, and you have not turned aside to uncleanness while you are under your husband's authority, be free from this water of bitterness that brings the curse. But if you have gone astray, though you are under your husband's authority. And if you have defiled yourself and some other man other than your husband has lain with you, then, and let the priest make the woman take the oath of the curse and say to the woman, may Yahweh make you a curse and an oath among the people. When the Lord makes your thighs fall away and your body swell, a lot of people think thigh is kind of a euphemism for the parts involved in the sin. May this water that brings the curse pass into your bowels and make your wounds swell and your thigh fall away. And you get the whole idea. Because again, it's not just, you know, sex is about pleasure, it's about procreation. So what's the whole idea? If she is guilty, the body parts involved in the sin will be disfigured, damaged, made painful, whatever. But the other part is, she can't have kids. The ability to have kids is taken away from her. Because this is a really big, not just the pleasure, but the procreative part is a big deal to God, especially in the context in which we're looking for the seed of woman and the seed of Abraham and inheritance being passed on clearly. She loses the right to have the blessing and benefit of what that act can bring. Make sense? The fact of mixing holy water with dust from the tabernacle, we get the location of that dust coming from, the tabernacle. It's a holy place and holy water. Dust as well, because here's the thing. What was the fundamental curse upon man? And I mean literally the man, Adam, when he's told he's going to have, in the context of the sin, he's going to have to work the soil by the sweat of his brow. For from dust you are, and to dust you return. It's ultimately a symbol of death. And so you have dust, a symbol of death, from the place where life itself is dwelling. Because that's where God, the tabernacle is where God's dwelling, right? So life itself is dwelling in the tabernacle, but a symbol of death mixed in. Because what happens when an unholy person, a sinful person, unclean person approaches a holy God? When you come near God, life or death sets stake, right? And of course, in her case, literally because her womb, the source of life, which is what a woman's womb is, that's where new life comes forth. Her ability to create and bear life is at stake as she drinks this. Powerful symbolism. Life and death involved in this. And the woman's ability to be a participant in the acts of giving life or participating in death at stake. And so there it is. And at the end of the day in all of this, you get down the bottom line, verse 28, if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, then she shall be free and she shall conceive children. And so there we go. So again, now you've got public sins going to be dealt with and private sins. And of course, by picking sexual sin, and then go a step further, sexual sin in the context of marriage, God has picked about the most private, the most intimate type of sin in one sense that you can think of, right? Because sexual sin gets very close to the nature of God himself and creating life, the two becoming one flesh and creating life. Like God says, let us make man in our image, and God creates life. The three in one creating life, the two become one creating life. And so one of the most secretive acts, private acts, intimate acts, and there's a lot, and easy to hide that sin. So more public and more private, but God will have his holiness, okay? There's that. Real quick, because the bell's going to catch us, never know the time. Chapter 6, that chapter 8 doesn't exist. That doesn't exist because chapter 6 goes on in the same way. But here's the important twist as we move into chapter 6. Well, for those who wanted a break there, it's natural for a break there. It's still all about holiness. That's what the Nazarite vow is about. Natsar is another Hebrew word for holiness or carries with the connotation of holiness. It's not the main one, but it's another one. So a Nazar is just a holy one, a set-apart one. But here's the key. We've already dealt with the priests and the Levites in this book who are set apart, holy to God. And the whole issue is holiness. God's going to have a holy camp. He's a holy God dwelling among us. And we're talking about this. We're talking about all night. This is about gradations of holiness. From the edge to the center, holy, 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 all the way through. What about the average Jew who's not a priest or a Levite, who's not only not involved in sin, but wants to be even holier to God than what God himself demands? So thoroughly devoted to God. You want to literally arrange your life around God's holiness. What can you do? Take a Nazarite vow and set you apart even more thoroughly with those three classic things, right? You got to keep yourself away from, I like to put more just fermented things, because that's the real concept. I'll come back to that in a sec. No fermented things, wine, but no fermented things, dead bodies, and cutting hair. And that makes perfect sense, because what all those things represent in some way, shape, or form is death and decay. Fermentation is a form of decay. That's why you're not, that's why a Nazarite, because what's the ultimate form of uncleanness, ceremonially speaking? Don't touch a dead body. Right? That's why the high priest, go back to the law in Leviticus, the high priest is told Because, and the high priest is uniquely holy among all the other classes of holy, so the priests and the Levites. Because the high priest is the only human who's allowed to go into the very presence of God itself behind the veil. And so if the ultimate uncleanness is death, unlife, lack of life, loss of life, you cannot go into the presence of capital L life, tainted in any way, shape, or form by that. That's why the high priest was not only supposed to stay away from death, even his own parents. Honor thy father and mother for him did not mean bury your parents. He could not bury his own parents because he must stay absolutely away from death and decay if he's going to go into the presence of God.
For that 1 year.
Say again?
For that 1 year.
Well, in general. Yeah. In general. Go back and read it. And so that's the thing. And so you've got the Nazirite vow. Stay away from death and decay, basically. Because dead bodies, fermentation, and cutting your hair, cutting off, dying. And so that's the end of it. And so there you go. Make yourself holy. If you want to be even more holy to the Lord, that's your option. So from the first part of this section, consequences for breaking holiness, either intentionally, unintentionally, publicly, or privately, that will be found out, that will be dealt with. To what about those who are not a problem, those who want to get as close to God as they can? I can't help I wasn't born a priest. Can't help I wasn't born a Levite, but I still want to do more. What can you do? You can be a Nazirite, God says. Welcome to the club. Here's what you can do. And then, significantly, it ends with the very familiar blessing, chapter 6. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the people of Israel, you shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you, the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So shall they put my name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them. Just like in Genesis, when God is done creating, what does he do? He blesses. Remember where we started tonight? This is all about a recreation, starting at Sinai when God comes down, begins to give a law, and then you can give a place where he can gather with his people, a surrogate Eden for a while, begin to organize the people back into decently in order, make divisions like in creation. When all is said and done and things are right and people are holy, what do you get? You get blessing. That's what you get. And the outcome of holiness is God can dwell among you, and you're not going to die, you're going to be blessed. Because what happens if God dwells among you and you're not holy? You die. Ask Nadab and Abihu. Ask Korah, Dathan, and Abiram here in a while. Ask Miriam and Aaron, would they mouth off? Right? The whole, having God live among you when you're not right with God is a very dangerous proposition. But this is Genesis all over again. When everything is as it should be, the end result is not death. The end result of God dwelling among you and you doing what you're supposed to be doing and staying holy is blessing. Make sense?
Yeah.
And that's this little interlude as we're walking from the outside of the camp to chapter 7, back to the dedication. That's the interlude. What protects you from the priests or Levites having to kill you? Chapters 5 and 6. That's one. And that's the kind of the executive summary of what they're going to be enforcing. And maybe kind of like, I'm not a native Texan, I wasn't born here, but I got here as fast as I could. The Nazirite vow was that for people who weren't priests and Levites. Maybe you weren't born that way, but you could still join in if you want to be part of people who take this seriously. And by the way, last little about jealousy. Remember what Phinehas is described as? We've mentioned Phinehas already. He really is an important character and figure in the book. In Numbers 25, he was jealous for God. It's not a negative word in Numbers, it's a positive word. I want things to be as they should be. And if they're not, we're going to fix it. And we're going to deal with it. Because it's not personal. It's not even personal between me and my wife. It's ultimately about giving God what he wants. As Paul puts it, none of us lives to ourselves. We may think we do, but we don't. And so it's always first and foremost about getting things arranged the way God wants them. That's the sense of jealousy of the husband. The same jealousy Phinehas has later on. It's not personal. It's not vengeful. It's God's holiness, and the holiness of God's camp must be maintained no matter how close to home it is. Make sense? All right. We'll see you next week, Lord willing.